Hey, I'm Eric Torenberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Mike Shinoda, lead singer and rapper of bands Linkin Park and Fort Minor. Linkin Park has recently launched a venture capital firm. We talk about everything tech, how and why he got into tech, what he wants to achieve, what he invests in. But we also talk about his music and entertainment career, how he thinks about making art versus making money off of his art, how he deals with success and still pushing it after he's made it, his story and the come up, and a lot more. Mike is a smart guy and an interesting guy too. The one thing I'm most curious about is what happens when you've tried so hard and got so far. So I guess I'm just kind of curious, like, in the end, does it really even matter? Does it? All right, here's Mike. Starting off, tell me what you're interested in doing in the tech space, and how did you get into it in the first place?
Well, I'll answer the second part first. The beginning of my interest in tech, I mean, first and foremost, my dad was in aerospace engineering, worked with computers all the time. My mom was actually a court reporter, and my dad brought home like one of the first Apple. I want to say it was the 2E, or I don't remember. It's like, you know, he brought home a computer when I was really young. And, you know, so I just kind of grew up using it. And then when I went to school, I was in school for illustration and design at Arts Center College of Design in Pasadena, which is it's a great school. It's a really rigorous program. And at the time there was, you know, they had one of the best computer labs for a design school, but that is to say that at the time it was like a lab. It wasn't laptops or anything like that. It was, you know, you had to go down to the basement to like use the computers, and I did, and I loved it, and I got, you know, from there I felt like I was pretty savvy, and I when we started to record our music, I kind of started the band with another friend around 96, 97 ish. And along the way, I was always the one to record the music, and it was always in the computer. And this was, by the way, at a time when most, you know, baby bands were definitely recording to tape or something similar, two inch tape or other kinds of tape. And, so, you know, we kind of came out at a time when that was the way it was done, and found, you know, ourselves bridging the gap between that and where we are now. And so, you know, it's always, technology's always played a role. When I first got my, when I got my first, like, first check that I could actually save any money, I decided with a little piece of it to buy some stock, because I had never done that before. And because I was such a fan of the computers I used in design, and, I grew up using Apple, I bought Apple stock, and this was before the iPod. Actually, the first time I bought it, I think, now the iPod had not come out, and then once the iPod came out, I bought more, and then once the iPhone came out, I bought more. So that was just for me, it was just a taste of what it could be and what it was like being a fan of a company, and their product, and that you know, love for the product, kind of, in one sense, allowing you to have like this deeper connection to what it was all about, you know.
So yeah, so Apple's a big. So you're into tech. Apple's a big tech company, but what got you into startups?
So as far as startups, I spoke on a panel at Blog World years ago, and I met Kevin Rose. I met a bunch of people all at the same time. There was like this mixer. I met Kevin. I met Tim Ferriss. I met Chris Sacca that weekend as well. So really bright guys who are all, you know, deeply involved in tech. And we, you know, we kind of just kept in touch, and they, each individually kind of led me into, you know, hey, have you heard about this? Have you heard about that? You know, we're investing in this thing. Maybe you want to think about it. And I casually started investing like little bits into different things. And what I really like about it, you know, it was never enough money that it was like made a huge difference or anything. I didn't treat it like gambling, like Vegas or anything. I like the fact that almost in a you know, the Apple thing. The reason I mentioned the Apple stock was that it creates a connection. You know what I mean? Like, it creates this, like, it's almost like because you know, I mean, you've got some skin in the game, and you already, you have to have already like, I wouldn't do that if I didn't already like or love the thing that I was getting involved in. And this kind of thing, this kind of investment allows for, you know, not only for me to like pay attention and really care, but also I find myself getting into great conversations with the founders and people on those teams and learning a lot. And for me, that, you know, that connection with smart people, innovative ideas, and people that want to, literally in some cases, they want to change the world. That's really exciting for me.
Yeah, you become friends with them. It's interesting how capital, how investing in someone can do that, can form a bond.
Yeah, and like I said, like I'd make it a habit of not investing in things just for the financial component. I think that I did that when I was, you know, 10 years ago, I would probably have done that. Now, not so much. I mean, it's just very thin. If it's just about like, oh, they're gonna, you know, it's just about money. It's, you know, that's not what my investment philosophy is based around, and that's not what the band's.
What is your investment thesis?
Well, the first and foremost, we want to invest in companies that we feel like we have a brand like alignment with, like what Linkin Park is about. Meaning, and that's a very, sometimes that's very amorphous, you know. But we know what that means, and there's a component of it that we want it to be innovative, we want it to be creative, we want it to do good for people, to make people feel good. We want to, you know, we want it to help be a catalyst for positive things or change in the world. And so those are the kinds of companies we're looking for. On a really like practical level, we want stuff, we're looking at stuff that's consumer facing that a lot of people can use. So that is to say that when people pitch like music apps and stuff like that to us, you know, most often we're not that I'm personally not that interested in it, because automatically if it's a music app, it's already like kind of niche.
But I bet everyone's pitching to you music stuff all the time.
You know, of course.
I worked for Nas's venture firm before Product Hunt, and it was amazing. Anything that had to do with rap or music or even entertainment, they assumed he'd be down 100%. But because he knows that industry so well, he knows how hard it is. He's like, no, show me the enterprise software stuff. You know,
that's funny. Yeah, that's true. It's the things that I see more often than not in the last like 3 or 4 years, the types of apps, for example, will be obviously some mashup of music and social network, which there have been, you know, we've been seeing those forever. And then now a lot of performance-based stuff where, like, you know, we can really make the average person sound like a really good singer. Think of, like, you know, the T-Pain app. You remember that Smule T-Pain app?
Yep.
We would, like, auto-tune your voice. Like, that type of thing is so easy. I mean, not easy for me, but I see it enough that I'm like, oh, it's a lot of people who are doing this. It's been done and it sounds good. Sure. But, you know, that's not sticky enough. That's not deep enough. Like, it doesn't like mean something to you. And for the people that it does mean something to, like, they're probably semi-pro singers anyway. And an app is not what they're looking for. I mean, they're looking to like record real music in a studio or at home on professional gear and like make a, you know, name for themselves.
So you're doing angel investing on the side. Well, why create the fund? And what are you looking to do with the fund?
Well, when I was doing it on my own, some of the first things that I had done, I invested in Spotify. I invested in Sonos, a couple of other things on my own, and a couple of things with the band. And the ones that panned out better were the ones I invested on my own. And the ones that we did with the band, I felt like we were doing a lot of heavy lifting and we weren't giving it 100% either. It was like we were choosing, it was almost like we were picking up the phone instead of like hunting down great companies to get involved with, which is never a good idea. And So the kind of realization that all of the guys in the band had was, look, we're deeply interested in this space. We love talking to the founders and the smart folks at the companies. Like, that's some of the most exciting stuff. And first and foremost, we're a band. I mean, we're not Stanford grads in computer science. What we do know is how to make a good song, and we know how to connect what we do with people. So the branding and the marketing, even the aesthetics to a large degree. We've got two guys, myself and Joe, like we both went to design school. So all of those components, we feel like we have that to offer. And depending on who we get involved with, we find that they usually have a lot to offer us in terms of, ideas and even in some cases, actual, technology that we can either, use their platform kind of in tandem with things that we're running with the band, or just learn from how they're approaching, different things in their business. And to be honest, in its most basic form, it's fun. It's inspiring and it's fun.
And it's interesting because not many artists have the kind of humility to, to pay to get into a deal. Like, they can't even comprehend that. But there's very few who understand kind of the power of that and kind of the multiples that these companies can have.
Yeah, I have to say that, I mean, we met, when we decided to get deeper into it and we decided to go with our fund, which, by the way, is called Machine Shop Ventures. Fund one is we're on our first fund, so, and it's not anything crazy. Like, we're not out there throwing, like, you're going to hear if you're not already hearing about it, actors and musicians and so on throwing $500,000 at some company and so on. I mean, that's not our deal at all.
Early stage,
I'd say that ours is like just past, like late early stage, if that makes sense. Like, we want them to have some kind of foundation laid out underneath them. We want them to be out of beta, to have something there the consumers and fans or whatever are using and enjoying, and we can look at it and say, okay, this is, it's gotten far enough that we can see what they're envisioning and how it's coming together. Yeah, and that's not to say that we won't get involved. Like, if we, get in on, in the case of like Lyft, for example, like that's a company that's already, well on their way, and we thought it would be a good fit for the portfolio, so we added Lyft. But the other ones, we have Robinhood in the portfolio, we have Ship, and Blue Bottle Coffee. And that gives you a sense of, like, the diversity that we're looking for and, kind of the entry point.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. So you mentioned in your podcast with Tim Ferriss that there was kind of this tension. You're in Los Angeles and a lot of people are after the fame, but you're really trying to make art and you didn't really resonate with it. And I'm going to go full circle here, but is there a tension or has there been a tension for you between making great art and making kind of art that's commercial, that's commerce?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's for any artist, that's a push and a pull, and everybody ends up in a different place with it. For me, when I growing up, I was definitely a music listener who I remember distinctly being a fan of, I think it was Red Hot Chili Peppers, and they were, because first and foremost, like, I was a rap fan for when I grew up, and then I eventually got into some rock, but a lot of it tended to be stuff that had some rapping in it, Rage Against the Machine and Chili Peppers, or rock artists who had been sampled, like Led Zeppelin or Jimi Hendrix. So I was, I listened to Chili Peppers for a while, and all of a sudden I remember a day when, like, this cheerleader girl who was like a friend of my friend, she came to school she was not digging for new music. Like, she was just listening to whatever was on the radio, and music was like a peripheral. It was like buying a new handbag for her. And she came to school with a Chili Peppers, patch on her backpack. And I went nuts. I was just like, you know, screw her and screw that band. And then I was like disowned them for a period of time because of this other person. Like, it was really, I mean, that's how we are. A lot of us, that's how we are when our thing gets like co-opted by like, you know, mainstream culture or whatever. And then, yeah, and then eventually I found myself like, you know, we made this music and we found ourselves in that exact situation where all of a sudden I looked out in the crowd and I went, oh my God, like, there are a lot of people, in this crowd, and there are people in the crowd that I could never be friends with. And is that okay for me, you know?
It's interesting. For me, that was Macklemore. You know, I was a big fan when he was with Independent for so many years. Mm. And then he started to get really popular. And I was like, oh, I don't know. You know, this is too poppy. But then he started to get all this, like, backlash and hatred. And then I said, no, I'm a Macklemore fan. So it's really interesting at this concept of fanhood and how it's, how there, you know, so many factors at play there.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I mean, because music, when I was in high school, for example, I wasn't choosing like what, you know, band or rap group t-shirt I was wearing strictly on the like statement of it, you know. It wasn't like I had friends that did that. It's like the people who, and we know these people now, they're even more obvious. It's like they're into a group who makes like insane music that is like nearly unlistenable, and they love that no one else is going to listen to it and it sounds like complete noise or chaos. And that's exactly why they claim that that's their favorite thing in the world. And I believe to some degree that those people do love that. But I believe there's also a component where they love saying they love that. You know what I'm saying? So for me, it was like I was kind of in the middle of that. That what I was listening to was mostly based on like what I loved. And what I loved happened to be non-commercial. And then there was a little bit of a component where, but if I saw somebody else wearing the t-shirt and had the patch on the backpack, I would actually disown the artist, which is fucked up. Like, that's not, I feel so like such an idiot for doing that, but that's how I was.
Do you think that the best art is both amazing and super accessible?
Well, my attitude, I remember sitting in the car with our guitarist, Brad, when we were probably just finishing college, and the band was, you know, we were working, like we were playing bigger and bigger shows in LA and had a couple people from labels coming out to see us. So it was, something was going on, but nothing was happening yet. And we talked about, you know, I think the conversation revolved around this subject. It was like, you know, if we write this kind of song, like those people would probably be even more interested. And if we write this kind of song, they definitely are going to get turned off. So what do we do? And he summed up the conversation so eloquently. He said, an idea is only as good as one's ability to execute it. And I loved that, partially because my attitude was like, if you've got a good idea, people should hear it. If you believe in it, I mean, whether that's a creative idea or an emotional like statement or whatever, if you believe in it and you think it's meaningful, then give it every chance to reach a lot of people. And that's kind of how we felt. It's like all of the stuff that was mashing up genres at that point. Like, keep in mind, like when Linkin Park started, we weren't called Linkin Park at the time, but when we started, you know, I grew up on hip hop first, and then a lot of rock, and then a lot of electronic, and then all of a sudden we were, you know, old stuff, new stuff. Like, we were very we loved so many different types of music, and it wasn't a surfacey love. A lot of bands were coming out in the late 90s, early 2000s who were mashing up specifically rock and rap, but you could tell they were really rock bands, and their interest in rap music was very thin, and it was always super aggressive and super, we called it frat rock. It's like smashing beers on your forehead kind of rap rock, you know, and misogynistic too, and just all kinds of stuff. So we were like, that wasn't our deal. Like, my hip hop vocabulary was deeper than my rock vocabulary.
Who'd you like in hip hop? Who'd you grow up with listening to in hip hop?
So I grew up, the first records I ever bought were Beastie Boys and Run DMC. I was like really influenced by a lot of the East Coast stuff early on, from the Molly Mall and all those, and like LL Cool J, Big Daddy Kane, Boogie Down Productions. And I lived in LA though, so a lot of my friends got like bussed in from like downtown LA or like West Los Angeles up to the Valley where I lived. And the school was like a third of the school or so, I think, was bussed in from LA. So they were bringing the stuff from the hood up to the Valley. And then I was hearing NWA and Ice-T and King T and so on. And up through, you know, so anyway, just to fast forward, at the time when we were starting the band, it's like some people would say, oh, what's your band sound like? Oh, we are a mix of rap and rock. We were very specific. We were like, look, here's what we like. We like The Roots. We like Mobb Deep. We like Portishead. We like Aphex Twin. We like Deftones. We like Rage Against the Machine. I mean, it was all like, you know, if you were to move 2 degrees away from any of those things, we'd go, no, not that. It's specifically these other things. And it wasn't just those bands. We could name off, you know, 100 of them, but they were always very specific.
Right. Now, I'm curious, and this is something I think about for myself as product owners started to build an audience, and as tech founders have become kind of new, you know, form of celebrity, is there something about fandom that's a bit unhealthy or that you would do different? Like, is there some sort of element of like, why do you like me so much? Or why do you care so much? You know, or like, I just want to be alone today. I don't want to, you know, answer this sort of stuff. Like, I mean, having a following or audience that you're beholden to, or is it just amazing? And I'm,
no, you know, there are days when, you know, I'll say that, I think because you guys, like, I think you would understand this, that certain forms of social media, like the communities on different platforms change over time. So when Facebook was new, it looked and felt different in the community than it is now, right? The age, I mean, first and foremost, the age. Second, like the places where people live. Like right now, I don't find that my American friends or our American fans are all that present on Facebook, but the international fans are definitely there. And for us, they outnumber the U.S. fans, like maybe, I don't know what, like 3-1, 5-7-1. Like it's a lot more international fans on Facebook. And then like Twitter, for me, my Twitter feed is actually pretty interesting, I feel like. And then I look at my mentions sometimes and it's really frustrating. You know, it's just like, there's not a lot of like thought going into what's happening there. When are you coming to my country? Or like just mental, like, you know, vomit. And then like I'm using a new, what is this app called? A friend of a friend just sent me a beta of the List app, and all it is lists. Like everybody makes a list and everybody comments on other people's lists, and that's just lists. And that people really put some effort in. Like it's enjoyable to read because of the format and because it's new and because they've reached out to their friends, and there's kind of a curation as far as like who's in the door at this point. And I know that if it blew up as big as, you know, Twitter, that the actual quality of the lists would like separate. Like you'd get a lot of the garbage and then a handful of ones that were really, really good.
Yeah. Well, do you ever look at people like, and we mentioned Kevin Rose or Chris Sacca, even though those aren't super great examples because they have a ton of fans too. But I'm curious, like more, you know, very successful tech people who aren't very public, who most people may not know, you know, maybe the founder of Ship once they, you know,
yeah,
blow up. Do you ever look at them and be like, oh, that would be nice to have that same level of success and access without having to, or is it more of a pleasure? And it's like, hey, I get to reach all these people.
Look, I'm grateful for the fact that we've actually minimized the amount of that kind of attention on us and on our band. You know, we had the opportunities at various points to get much more in the face of the mainstream pop culture. To put it in context, our first album, Hybrid Theory, was the best-selling album on the planet that year. And that was, by the way, that was the year that like Britney Spears debuted. So when the label told us, you sold more albums than Britney Spears this year in the world, we were all looking at them like, that's got to be a mistake. Because part of it was because we weren't getting, like, if she went out to the mall, she'd like go to the hospital. Like, it'd be a chaos, right? If we went to the mall every day. I mean, we were always out. We didn't, you know, nobody really was acting that way to us. And part of it may have been the way that we treated people, but I think there is definitely a component of it that we never tried to get that kind of attention. And it's always stayed that way. So there is always this like sense of like, I think it's part of it is just like the type of music we played. Part of it is just the type of people we are, that you can just sense that the guys are in it because we love to play music and we love what we're doing. It's not so much about like getting, you know, on a magazine or getting some, you know, attention in that way. I mean, that stuff is, it might feel good in the moment, but it doesn't like really, unless you've got like a message, unless you've got something incredible that you're a reason you need to get in front of everybody's face. We've always felt like our music is like an open door, like, come on in, you know?
Yeah, no, it's interesting now that you say that. I think, you know, everyone knows Linkin Park, you know, and that's kind of first and foremost, it's the brand first, and then, you know, then it's your, then it's you, and then it's you guys.
Yeah.
But that's interesting.
Yeah, even with Fort Minor, so like right now I just put out a Fort Minor song, which is what I call my solo stuff, or that's what I call my stuff when it's not Linkin Park. Like, if it's not Linkin Park, then it's Fort Minor. So that's taken different shapes over the years, but the reason I called it Fort Minor originally, the first thing was that I didn't want to call it Mike Shinoda. Like, I felt weird doing something separate from the band and then making it about like my name. That felt very like it could be misconstrued as like a egotistical play, or like I was trying to be my little own like star. And so I named it because I wanted it to be very clear that that's not what it was about.
Yeah, that is interesting. When you look at music or when you look at art, it's a question I've been having. I'm curious your take on it. Who determines quality? Is it just whatever the audience likes best, whatever the most people like the most? Is it the critics? Is it some sort of hybrid? What determines quality?
Well, music, I mean, you could answer that question so many different ways. If you're talking about, I mean, it depends on what you're talking about. If you are just talking about music, it's definitely to a large degree subjective, even to the extent that like just the sonic shape of a song differs from genre to genre. So if I mean, this will get a little bit in the weeds, a little techie or whatever. It's the sound of a modern jazz record versus the sound of a modern EDM record versus the sound of a modern rock album. If you were to look at those like on an EQ spectrum, the EDM album, for example, will be smashed all the way up. It'll look like a bar of noise, because what they do is they compress and limit the shit out of their music to the point where it's much louder than everything else. But what the loudness does is it removes the peaks and valleys, so it's flat. When you get into like more, I don't know, what do you want to call it, like jazz, like more what you think of as like adult and adult contemporary kind of music, it tends to be quieter and much more ebb and flow as far as like the waveforms and everything. And also, by the way, because it's not as flat, I find that it's more, you've got this roundness to the sounds. Like, well, anyway, so the point is, an EDM fan listens to EDM and goes, that's the best sounding thing I've ever heard. And then they go and listen to jazz record, and that's boring. A jazz fan listens to the EDM stuff, just the sound of the waveform is like totally, it's a turnoff to them because they like the other thing, they're used to the other thing. I would imagine that if you mastered an EDM record, like a jazz record, even if it was a hit song that people loved, but if you just mixed and mastered it the way the jazz song got done, it would be a flop. Like, people would hate it.
Mm. Let's say within a specific genre, for EDM, for example, is it all relative or subjective from there? Or is it kind of like, this is just a good song?
My attitude is on all of this stuff. And there was a moment when EDM was like, oh, it's the next big thing. Like, you kept seeing like especially like the Grammy parties and stuff like that, and Grammy show. You'd see a lot of like the labels like sticking EDM artists up and, you know, in the forefront of those. That year, a lot of, you know, electronic artists were trying to figure out how to jump from their subculture into the mainstream. And the bottom line is, I think that really what it comes down to is a song. Like, you can have the best sounding thing that appeals to the most people and it's memorable and whatever, but song means to me that there has to be like an emotional story or journey that it takes you on. It doesn't have to be a traditional song. Like, I was just listening to an electronic station with a friend, and Massive Attack and Moby came on, and I was like, man, you remember these guys came out and they were big. Like, everybody knew who Massive Attack was and Moby was, but you didn't necessarily know their songs, but it was just, they were big because they moved you and people were interested in it. And you knew that there was something really cool and meaningful, even though it wasn't like a literal like narrative or like, you know, the kind of like tangible lyrics that you'd have on Taylor Swift or whatever. And so, yeah, it doesn't have to be like fit in a box, but it definitely has to be a song. And in our case, we've always written our songs in a way that, as you said, we usually write our songs in a way that can be played on instruments other than the ones we end up recording them with. So in other words, you can take What I've Done or New Divide or Burn It Down and just do vocal and piano, and it's still a good song.
Right. I mean, have you had some songs or something where you're like, I like this, or I like this the most, actually, but I know that it just won't do that well, or that no one will like it.
That was our whole last album.
I feel you. But you're proud of it, right?
We intentionally, like, the moment, let me tell you about the Hunting Party album real quick. At the time, all of the stuff on alternative radio was basically, they were sharing playlists with pop radio. So in other words, like, years before, rock was rock and pop was pop, and you'd have like a little bit of like a overlap in the Venn diagram. But in the last couple of years, they went like this. They went like right over top of each other. And so the alternative songs were pop songs. And the alternative stations lost, from my taste, they lost their edge. It was all very sleepy and kind of like this, like, it was different versions of sleepy. So I was looking to listen to, as a fan, and as I was driving around, just looking to listen to something that had more energy and maybe a little more aggression or just some kind of like intensity. And it wasn't on the alternative stations and it wasn't on the rock stations. And, so we decided to kind of like make it ourselves. It was like, okay, there's a gap and we can fill it. And so I realized, I started making demos, and what that sounded like was pretty aggressive, maybe a little abrasive. And so I called management and I said, hey, here's the deal. Like, this is what it sounds like, and this is what the plan is. Like, are we screwing ourselves? Are we just not going to be able to get any radio airplay or whatever? Like, are we going to be, you know, because marketing is a component, you know? And they were like, yeah, like, you're screwing yourself a little bit. But at the end of the day, like, when it comes to music, if you believe in it, and it's first and foremost has to be about that emotional connection and the expression of, you know, your ideas and your art. What, you know, the balance between that and the commerce is up to the artist. And we chose, on this most recent record, we chose to make an album that was exactly what we wanted to listen to. And we knew that the fans of that album, The Hunting Party, it was a smaller group of people. They weren't going to express their affection for that music by, you know, calling in and tweeting and texting radio stations or any of that stuff. They were just going to come to the shows. And truth be told, it was a smaller audience, just like we knew it was going to be, but they were more avid. They were more excited. They felt like, in some of the words of the fans that we met out there, it was like, nobody's making good, loud, aggressive, you know, hard rock / metal albums. You've only got a handful of, in the scope of all the music out there, it's a much smaller group of people that are doing it. So to have a band that's as big as Linkin Park do it, like actually choose to do it, made a bunch of them really happy, which was great. I mean, we just felt this, like, almost it was like it built this like camaraderie or this community.
It's refreshing. Yeah, definitely.
It was fun.
Do you see tech and startups as art?
Sometimes. Sometimes there can be cases. I mean, it's a little harder. When you're talking about like the overall goals and generally what like running one of those businesses is about. Like when I think of Blue Bottle Coffee, I mean, there's an art component in the sense that they really brand themselves well. They've got an aesthetic and a feel, a touch and a feel, and an attention to quality that musicians can definitely relate to. I mean, they're a great example actually of that, what you're asking, because they have to make the same kinds of decisions that artists have to make, in the sense that they've got what they believe, what most people believe, is a very high quality product. And they want to try and maintain high quality while getting to a larger audience. So I've heard, like, out in the wild, like, just at a coffee shop, I've heard people talking about, oh, have you tried Blue Bottle? It's really good, and so on. And I'm just listening in, and the guy was like, yeah, you know, like, Starbucks just, like, they just, their stuff just tastes like shit because they, you know, built such a big empire, and they're just like the McDonald's of coffee. Like I used to love that, but now that they've gotten so big, like their product actually sucks. And it was an interesting way. I felt like I don't ever hear anybody talk about coffee that way. But it resonated with me in the sense that I, you know, that is kind of how we look at the music. It's like, well, you could go that route and be that like Starbucks, or you could take the Blue Bottle approach and say, you know, we're going to build as big and as fast as we can, but we don't want to sacrifice our quality to get there.
Yeah, no, definitely. Okay, I'm going to transition to some broader questions. When have you been most proud of yourself?
I don't know about most proud of myself. I'm having a really good, this is a funny time to ask that question, because I just put out the Fort Minor song, Welcome. And in doing so, I mean, quick story on that, like, I wasn't writing a Fort Minor song. I wasn't even writing Linkin Park. So I was just writing. And I did it, and I listened to it, and I went, holy shit, this is a Fort Minor song. I haven't made a Fort Minor song in so long. And I decided to put it out, decided to make a 360 video for it. I decided to do this really fun like art project involving 1,000 vinyl jackets, created a mural out of those, and then we're selling those. I've signed every single one of them. We're selling them on the website. And as part of the, you know, the launch and as part of, you know, promoting the song, I've done a couple of performances. I did a live performance on Conan, and I did a live show, an hour long one man show last night. And I've never done those things alone before. And it was scary, man. I was nervous. I haven't been this nervous. I can't even think of the last time I was this nervous. I was, especially for the Conan thing, because it was the first thing I did, and I just had to play the one song. But I was like waiting all day just to have my little 3 minutes. Like, they did a dress rehearsal in the morning, and then you're just hanging out and waiting. And I did some interviews and stuff in the meantime, but I kept thinking like, oh God, like, what if I screw this up? What if I screw that up? I don't have anybody else to like look at and be like, well, I hope they were paying attention to Chester, because I just screwed up. I'm just the only one on stage. So that, I felt like, you know, I did those, I did the show last night. That last night was the full set, and I didn't fall flat on my face. So I feel good about that.
Awesome. And I got to say, you know, the song is fantastic. And growing up, you know, before basketball, every basketball game I would listen to Remember the Name.
Cool. Awesome.
To pump me up. So
that song is so funny, man. I never would have imagined like the life that song has had in sports. You know, it's just like, it's so special. Like, it's such a unique thing for, I mean, I grew up playing basketball, so I'm not very good, but I love watching it, and I still play once in a while. But yeah, to be able to go to basketball games and see people and hear the song and, you know, see people into it is always a treat for me.
And I'm hugely into hip hop, and I like to rap myself. And it's just amazing listening to that song or breaking it down. It makes it look so simple, but, you know, right? Like it's so accessible, but it's so good. And that's where I felt that, and that some of the others, you know, raps as well. I mean, it's just, it's awesome. People sometimes equate talent with complexity. I don't know, you know, Aesop Rock?
Yeah, I know the ASAP Rocky and those guys.
Yeah.
I don't know them. I know, I like them.
I'm talking, ASAP Rocky's like Def Jux from like the 90s LP.
That? Oh, Def Jux.
Yeah.
Wow. No, I'm not familiar with ASAP Rock.
Anyways, there's these kind of like, I was a huge big fan, but these rappers that were very...
Oh, ASAP. Yeah. I thought it was just ASAP. Yeah, yeah, no, yeah. I know who ASAP Rock is. Yes, yeah. Definitely. Now, he had a track like last year or 2 years ago. That's got to be like his third or fourth album at this point, right? But he had a track that I loved that's called ZZZ Top.
Yeah.
Hear that one?
Yes.
Oh, that's great.
I'm a big fan, but it's hard to follow his lyrics. I mean, he certainly has a very niche audience, which I'm a big fan of, but it's just, I think it's incredible when a song can appeal to both people with high taste, but also everyone can understand it. I don't know, there's something to be said for that. What have you not done yet that you need to do? You know, what's left to achieve? What are the big arrows to hit?
I just ride the wave. It's like I always find new goals and new goals to try and strive for and new things to learn, you know, on a small level, like all the time, and on a bigger level all the time. It's like, I'm definitely not at a loss for things that I want to do or wish I could do. I mean, you can see that if you follow me on Twitter or Instagram. Like on Instagram, for example, you'll see I'm constantly drawing. I'm constantly like, we're always performing. I like to create stuff. So yeah, like my Instagram feed is full of it. And I mean, you know, I could go and I've done art shows before, but like doing an art show, for example, like in one space, paintings on the wall or whatever, like that takes a lot of time. And I get these like, you know, to your point, like what is there to do? I have the ideas of like, oh, this is a thing I could do. I have those ideas all the time. And I actually have to like tell myself to stop, because if I don't, I mean, there's no way I have enough time in the day to do all of those things. So I have to kind of be more selective about where I do spend my time.
And how do you prioritize? Like, what is the criteria for which you evaluate what's worth doing?
Well, the band is first. I mean, Linkin Park is first on the list at all times.
Even though you've achieved so much with it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's because it's the foundation. Like, I feel like if you've built, we've built something that took a lot to get it here. And it's really, we're lucky to have, for it to have gotten to be the way it is. We're lucky to have had songs that reached so many people and the opportunities to play, you know, in all of the places that we played and so on. And meanwhile, that platform gives us the opportunity to do many other things. So whether it's Fort Minor or whether it's stuff with our charity, Music for Relief, or, you know, the VC fund, those things all kind of sit on top of the foundation. So we have to keep that foundation strong, not because we have to, but because we want to.
And it enables all the other activities.
Yeah. And by the way, if we were doing, like, if things had worked out differently and I was a graphic designer or like some kind of like, I would have ended up probably if I had stayed in design and the band had kind of come and gone, I would have ended up in either graphic design or concept art. Like I loved the idea of doing concept art for whatever TV or film or just anime. I think you'd probably animation, maybe sci-fi or fantasy or something like that. And I would have inevitably been doing music every weekend anyway. You know, I would have been spending money to be able to play music.
And it's interesting because you're so talented at a bunch of things. What do you identify?
Oh, go on.
Oh, sorry, I was just talking about myself. what do you identify? What's your core competence? Like, what are you best at?
I'd say I was going to say like drawing first and foremost is like the two things I've done since I was little, 3, 4, 5 years old, were drawing and playing piano. So when it comes to music, everything comes back to piano. And when it comes to aesthetics, everything comes back to like holding a pencil in my hand and making like whatever I'm seeing up here, putting that down on paper.
Yeah. And so you might not be the best drawer in the world or the best piano player in the world, but maybe you're the best drawing piano player. Like, it's sort of a combination of skills.
But when you talk about like a core competency, though, it's I think of that as like, what skill can you use to achieve multiple outcomes?
Got you.
Right? So even in the case of like mixing songs or whatever, or writing, and like anything we do in music, it'll probably come back to one of those two things. Like even I use like storytelling and compositional like concepts in, you know, composition and storytelling and various things that I get from my education and my experience in visual arts, and I apply them to a song. I mean, even to the extent that, like, when I went to school at Art Center, that we would do these, we'd have to do critiques every week, and you'd put your stuff up in front of the whole class, and they would tell you why it's horrible, they'll point out everything you're doing wrong. And I learned very quickly how to take criticism, how to like give criticism in a constructive way. Like the first couple weeks of art school are just horrible because nobody's really that good at like criticizing and taking criticism. So everybody's like way too timid or way too bold with how they're criticizing somebody else's art. Like you spend 20 hours on a painting, you don't want to hear somebody, you know, bullshitting about your composition and going on and on and on about why it's terrible or whatever, just saying awful things about it. As you get a little more experience in it, you learn to be able to frame those things in a way that people can like actually, you can actually get through and not and be constructive about it. And then on the other end, you can learn to take a great deal of criticism and be okay with it and actually do something with it. And if I didn't have that experience, I feel like our studio experience with a band would be much different. Like when we're in the studio, people say things regularly that an outsider would think are totally off limits to say, maybe too direct or almost too critical or I don't know what. And that's just the way it is. Like we leave the ego at the door, and we just, if you have something to say, say it, and let's get the song to where it needs to go.
Yeah. If you were 21 in 2015, what would you do?
What would I do? If I was the same kind of 21-year-old I was back then, I'd be drunk. We were actually, I mean, that's an exaggeration. But I was forced to be, it's an exaggeration because I was kind of forced to be mature for my age at that time, because at school, the average age there was, they didn't really let people in out of school. Rather from high school to Art Center. They only let like, you know, 10 to 15 people in who were high school age, high school grads. Everybody else was already a professional. So I was 18 going to school with, you know, 30-year-olds. And so that changes the dynamic.
Would you go into something else, you know, knowing what the world is like today?
I don't think that, like, for me, I think, I don't know if it's just me or if it's our kind of generation. Is it me, or do we not think about tech? It's like language. Like, if you speak multiple languages fluently, that means you think in those languages, right? If you speak English and you speak Japanese, and you think in Japanese when you're speaking Japanese, or when you're talking to somebody who speaks Japanese. When you're learning them, you speak English, and if you try and speak Japanese, you think in English, and then you translate, and then you talk in Japanese. That's how I feel like older people think about tech. Like they're like, oh, tech is like a thing. It's like a useful tool, or it's like a way to get to consumers or something. It's like I don't ever think about tech as like this external weird other thing. Like it's just something that, I mean, it's just an extension of like how we communicate and how we do things. Like even when you ask the thing about like, you know, when I was talking about Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, Snapchat, whatever, we're often on panels about, you know, marketing and social media and whatever, and even getting the like offer to be on the panel or to come to the event, I'm like, well, if you're asking about like, oh, what's your approach with social media? It's kind of like, maybe you're a lost cause. Like it's just so far gone. You don't have a chance of getting it.
It's so ingrained.
Yeah.
That's interesting. But would you have a desire to learn it at a younger age, like learn to code or something, or get into startups?
Oh yeah, for sure. That's something that I did miss out on. It would probably be very hard for me to get into now, even if I dropped everything else in my life and just devoted myself to that. I feel like I might be aged out on that. I just have too much to catch up on, and you know, your brain's more of a sponge when you're little. Like, I'm so excited that they're offering like coding and like 3D printing and I'm so at preschool level now, I think, and maybe kindergarten and grade school. I mean, for if you think about it, for like a 6-year-old to be doing intro to coding, that's remarkable. That's insane. And they're, by the way, they're like, you know, these little tiny kids are starting to see VR already. Like, it's going to be incredible to watch what they do with the world as we get older.
Yeah. Yeah. Who do you most admire, or what types of people do you most admire or seek to emulate in some way?
Some of my, I don't know what you'd call them, mentors and people I look up to are, I mean, I have a tendency, like I said, like I tend to want to like go out in 100 different directions at all times. I'm not like scatterbrained. I'm just almost like easily distracted. And I get excited about stuff and I want to make cool things and be involved in cool projects and so on. I'll give you one example, like Rick Rubin, for example, is a guy that when I speak to him, I feel like there's a stillness and a focus about Rick that I admire. And we've talked about it. Like, he's like a Phil Jackson, you know?
A guru, yeah.
It's a guru. But it's almost like a caricature. People put that on him. It's like some kind of caricature. But it's pretty legit. Like, it's not, you know, it's not silly at all. It's pretty real. You know, he can get to the bottom of whatever the thing it is that you're talking about, like, pretty quickly and not really, I don't know how to describe it, but I think it is that focus and that stillness and that ability to turn down the noise that, I don't know if it's a skill you can learn, but I want to try to.
And that's meditation. That's, you know, reflection, like,
yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot lately, because I've done some meditation before. I kind of went in and out on it. It's just, you know, like most people, it's just hard to take time out to do that or to even remember to do it.
Mm-hmm. For someone really trying to get to know you, if they really knew you as a person, what would they know about you? What's something important for them to know about you?
That's a good question. Which I'm trying to think of something we haven't already talked about. I mean, I'm a family person, and I really want to, like, you know, keep my family life and my work life in balance. And there's a weird interplay there, because number one, in order to make that happen, I have to make time, right? I have to have to take time away from music and all the related stuff to just spend with the family. When I do that, I'd turn off the phone and everything, or at least keep it, you know, minimal. Then at the same time, when I come back to the music, a lot of times it's like the fans might say, for example, like, oh, you know, why don't you come play here? Or why don't you do more for us this way? Like, we would love to hear more Fort Minor music. We would love for you to come to these shows and play for us. And truth be told, in the universe of possibilities, I could do that. But I've chosen to go and do and spend time with my family. But I can't necessarily tell the fans that, because number one, it's not an easy thing to explain to people. Like, they don't really want to hear that shit. And second, in order to, like, protect the family and protect our private lives, most of the guys in the band really don't talk about the family. So if you don't talk about the family, you can't use the family as an excuse, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, that's interesting.
It's a weird interplay. I don't know if I described it very well.
No, you didn't. I could also see a potential critique from a super fan, like, don't you hang out with your family, or are you, you know, what about your, and you could be like, I do, I just can't talk about it.
I do, but I also don't, but you who are asking that may not be creepy, but there are creepy people listening, and so, yeah, I'm not going to talk about that.
Right, exactly. Okay, last couple questions. So related, what do you want people to say at your funeral?
I won't dictate that. I think the best way to go about it is to let them to do whatever I'm going to do, and they can say what they're going to say about me.
Do you think it'd be a small one or a big one or?
I hadn't thought about it.
Okay. Do this is kind of a silly question. Do professional musicians like yourself and other people who are fans, do you guys casually freestyle rap for fun?
I used to, but for me, I find that I found at a certain point that I feel like I have something to say, and the best way for me to get it across is to spend time writing it out
and crafting it.
Freestyling is fun and all when you're just screwing around, but again, like if I'm going to be hanging out and just chilling, then it's probably like go to a movie, go to dinner, something like that. If we're doing music, like I'm probably a little more, I don't know, maybe a little more like, let's make something.
Yep. No, I'm with you. Cool. Well, Mike, thank you for taking the time. The project is awesome. There will be links to it. And I thought this was a fascinating conversation.
Thanks, Eric. This was really fun. This was awesome. And thanks for having me on.
Awesome. Thank you for taking the time.